This is The Guardian.
Whether you know your kimchi from your kefir or it's your first time boiling an egg, you'll be able to make delicious meals easily with The Guardian's new Feast app. Discover vibrant vegan dishes with me, Mira Soda, hearty comfort foods with Nigel Slater, bold flavours with Yota Motulenghi, and many more tasty offerings from expert Guardian cooks. Experience the ultimate cooking app, Feast, today. Download now and enjoy a 14-day free trial. Terms and conditions apply.
After the horrific knife attack that so far left three children dead, rioters attacked a local mosque and fought police on Tuesday night in Southport on Merseyside. Before the riot, Reform UK's leader Nigel Farage decided to publish a video questioning whether the public had been given the whole truth.
I just wonder whether the truth is being withheld from us. I don't know the answer to that, but I think it is a fair and legitimate question.
We'll speak to our reporter who's been in Southport all week. We'll also be talking about the Chancellor Rachel Reeves, tax rises and spending cuts, and the Tory leadership race. I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Week in the UK for The Guardian. We're recording this on Wednesday, 2 days after the knife attack in Southport. So far, it's left three girls dead. And at the time this was recorded, six other children were continuing to receive treatment, with two remaining in critical care, but in a stable condition. On Tuesday night, there was a riot outside a local mosque in which police vehicles were set alight and more than 50 officers were injured. Merseyside police have said that the riot started when a large group of people, who the police believe to be supporters of the English Defence League, threw things at the mosque. There is a wider context for these disturbances. They look like the latest manifestation of an increasingly familiar story. A huge amount of misinformation online, including the suggested identity of the attacker, allegations that the police are suppressing details about the case, and anti-immigration rhetoric from the far-right activist Stephen Yaxley Lennon, better known as Tommy Robinson. This element of what's happened now has blurred into Westminster politics, thanks partly to a video posted by Nigel Farage, the leader of Reform UK and the recently elected MP for Clacton. On Tuesday afternoon, before the riot started, he posted a video online asking why the incident was not being treated as terror-related, and also asking whether, quote, the truth is being withheld from us, unquote. With me now is The Guardian's North of England correspondent, Hannah Al-Othman, who's been reporting on the attack and its aftermath. Hannah, we've had some technical difficulties connecting to you, but we're grateful to have you on. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So can you just remind us what happened earlier this week in terms of the aftermath of that awful knife attack and how the events of Tuesday night, from your perspective, started to take shape?
Yes, there was a peaceful vigil in the town centre, and that, as you might expect, passed off entirely peacefully. But then, as that drew to a close, a second protest, which the police had said they were not made aware of. And basically what happened was the protesters were trying to target a mosque. So the police did not have prior intelligence that that would be the target. But when these groups of mostly men, because they were mostly men, arrived at St. Luke's Road, which is where they'd organised the protests to take place, they began, whether that was pre-planned or not, targeting this mosque. But basically, the police stopped them from reaching their target, their intended target, and so then they turned against the police and turned violent, and then they began basically using anything they could as missiles, so beer bottles from sort of bins behind pubs, huge, like big, heavy planters. They were tearing down walls and dismantling those to use the bricks. I saw men ripping open black rubbish bags, rifling through there for anything to throw. And it got really, really ugly.
Okay. I would imagine the fact that the people we're talking about attack the mosque gets us into the nature of the information, or misinformation, more accurately, that they got from somewhere, right? That's kind of the nub of it. Is that your understanding?
There was certainly an entirely false name being spread around on social media as, you know, as an alleged name of the perpetrator. It's completely wrong. I'm not convinced this person even exists. But what people are saying, it was an Arabic name. They're saying he was Muslim. That's entirely false, that name that was going around. But I do think some of it is, yes, due to misinformation, but some of it is also just an excuse, and people may be aware that that's not necessarily true or that's not necessarily correct, but they still, there was a sense that this has been whipped up and you know, people are turning on, you know, anyone who they think is different to them, or people who have underlying feelings about Muslims, British Muslims, just finding this as an excuse to inflict violence.
Did you get the sense that what you were watching was organised? And I suppose there'd be one sort of giveaway there, which was that it would involve people who were not from that part of Merseyside and might have travelled some distance to join in. Was that your sense of it?
So I heard a lot of local accents, not necessarily Southport, but certainly wider Merseyside. But we do know that some people definitely travel for this. Organisations that monitor the far right, like Hope Not Hate. My understanding is that they've identified people who they know are based elsewhere in the country. I was speaking to the Metro Mayor, Steve Rotherham, about this earlier. You know, he said, and the Southport's MP, who's actually only been in position for a few weeks, Patrick Hurley, both of them spoke about people being bussed in from elsewhere. So yes, there certainly is that sense. But also I get the sense that sort of national networks of people who are whipping up this hatred, who are spreading this misinformation online, are having that very, you know, real impact on the ground. And I had people, not people who were involved in this disorder, but just ordinary people that I was speaking to in Southport, reporting some of that stuff that I knew to be false, repeating that back to me. And so I think, you know, this online stuff does filter through, both to people who are local, but also, you know, to incite people who may have that strength of feeling that they're willing to travel.
So you're watching it from a distance. It feels like, as I said earlier, really, another example of one of those occasions when we all know there's this constant, hateful, very often sort of mendacious noise happening online. And then for whatever reason, there's a sudden sort of pretext and it becomes physically real, usually in the form of violence. And suddenly it's in front of you, right? And in that sense, it's a story that keeps happening over and over again. You, I know, covered disturbances outside asylum seeker accommodation in Knowsley, another part of Merseyside, which outwardly sort of had some of the same sense, certainly the same ugliness, but also they seemed to indicate that link between what was going on in the real world and stuff that had been bubbling away online for a long time. Did you feel you were covering a story that in some sense was sort of familiar?
The awful thing now is you sort of get a sense for it. So I remember being in the village in Banks on Monday night, you know, where police had raided the house linked to the suspect. And I remember thinking, this feels really febrile. This feels like it's going to kick off. And when you're, you know, doing a job like I do and you're monitoring all that online, but you're also on the ground and you're getting, you know, you can read the feelings, the emotions, the anger from people. You absolutely sort of know now when it's likely that you are going to see some kind of violence and disorder.
Has anyone in Southport that you've spoken to mentioned Nigel Farage in the video that he posted?
Not today. What I did notice was that some of the messages that were displayed by, you know, what the police have described as thugs and hooligans are some of the same messages that are put out by, you know, what are now mainstream politicians. Things about small boats, invasions, we want our country back. That was one of the chants. And, you know, those messages to me don't feel that dissimilar to, I worked on the general election campaign. It doesn't feel that dissimilar. Yes, you know, it was an entirely different situation. And I'm not saying that, you know, that necessarily, you know, people who voted Reform would want to go out and commit any kind of violence like that. But what I did notice is that some of the messaging that we're now seeing in mainstream politics was the same as we're seeing on these violent demonstrations.
You're in Southport now. Just tell me what it feels like.
So today it actually feels really, really lovely. I was down at the scene of the disorder earlier and, you know, we had supermarkets coming round offering everyone sort of water and snacks. We've got like bricklayers who are fixing the mosque and rebuilding garden walls. And then, you know, you've got people from nearby shops turning up with pizzas for people at the mosque and people who are volunteering. And it really does feel like, you know, there is a real sense of the community pulling together and wanting to, you know, show what Southport really is about. It feels very, very different to how it did last night.
It's a community now dealing with two lots of trauma, isn't it? In the sense that there's the awful trauma, which is ongoing to do with the knife attack and the killings and the fact that children are still in hospital. And there's the trauma from the riot as well. I mean, it's a hell of a thing of a combination of things to have to cope with. Thank you so much for speaking to us, Hannah.
No worries.
Thank you. Pippa Carrera is The Guardian's political editor and, as you doubtless know, the co-host of Politics Weekly Westminster. She joins me now. Hi, Pippa.
Hi there, John.
Hi. We've just been speaking to Hannah Al-Othman, who's been in Southport all of this week. Last night, Nigel Farage posted a video on X about the attack and, as he sees it, some questions surrounding it. Let's hear what he said.
The police say it's a non-terror incident, just as they said the stabbing of an army lieutenant colonel in uniform on the streets of Kent the other day was a non-terror incident. I just wonder whether the truth is being withheld from us. I don't know the answer to that, but I think it is a fair and legitimate question. What I do know is something is going horribly wrong in our once beautiful country.
What he has said, and maybe the way that he has said it, has not gone down well in Westminster at all. He's the leader of a party, as we both know, with five MPs, and he seems to be sort of flirting with political misinformation or disinformation here.
Yeah, I mean, he really does, especially given the origins of some of the conspiracy theories that were doing the rounds last night and which many feel were behind sort of getting that crowd of far-right protesters into fever pitch mode and those awful scenes which Hannah witnessed up in Southport last night. And the immediate response has been one of anger, really, at what they regard, what lots of people regard as a very sort of irresponsible intervention by Nigel Farage, who has a big following on the right across the spectrum.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we had Brendan Cox, who was the widow of Joe Cox, the murdered MP, on the radio this morning talking about, you know, imagine your response to the death of three children being to peddle conspiracy theories that incite a riot, saying that he deserves to be labelled far right and that everybody who's associated with him or normalised him or promoted him should be ashamed, and really sort of strong words there. And then we had sort of, you know, former MP Nicholas Soames, Winston Churchill's grandson, saying he's currently a peer, a Tory peer in the House of Lords, saying it's absolutely disgraceful implication, you know, at what obviously what was like a really difficult time. Labour MPs as well, frontbench Jess Phillips condemning it
as
well.
Yeah, I was going to mention Jess Phillips. So what she says relates implicitly to the substance of what he said, but also the fact that he said it on a social media platform rather than in Parliament, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. He didn't turn up. She says he grifted instead. He could have gone to Parliament, where Yvette Cooper last night had a statement giving MPs right across the board, from Reform to the Tories to Labour, the opportunity to ask specific questions about what was going on and about the sort of the police response to what was an awful tragedy. And instead, he decided that he would hop on social media where presumably he felt more of his supporters would see it. And inevitably his words would have, you know, a much more sort of focused impact. So
yeah,
I think
yeah.
The whole thing smacks of irresponsibility. It's actually quite interesting when you look at Farage and his approach to politics. He's always done it from the sidelines. He's always been the one he's been smart about his use of social media. You know, you'll remember those images, those videos of him in the White Cliffs of Dover talking about small boat crossings way before anybody else was, before it became a mainstream issue. And he recognises the power of social media, but he's never had to be accountable in quite the same way before.
Not since
he was an MEP, because despite his multiple attempts to become an MP, this is the first time he's actually managed it.
Yeah, also the context for what he's said is interesting as far as the Conservative Party is concerned, for reasons we'll come on to discuss in a minute. But given that one of the issues in play in the Tory leadership election is the extent to which the Conservative Party ought to kind of move in a Farage-y, reformy kind of direction. I mean, that's definitely being discussed, right? And right at that point, he shows you that in the minds of most parliamentarians, he's kind of beyond the pale. Do you know what I mean? It'll be quite sobering, I think, for a lot of Conservatives to reflect on this intervention.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of flirtation with, well, with Farage himself, but with sort of, you know, the populist right more broadly at one end of the spectrum in the Conservative Party. And at a moment after a crushing election defeat, when the party, as you say, we'll come on to this, but where the party is reflecting on what it stands for and what its response should be, pitching to the right to reform and that base of right-wing voters is one of the options on the table. And I think this make a lot of more mainstream Conservative MPs feel actually a bit queasy.
If you want an in-depth report on what's been happening in Southport, you can listen to our sister podcast, Today in Focus, where Helen Pidd will be speaking to The Guardian's Josh Halliday, who's been in Southport all week, and Joe Mulhall from Hope Not Hate. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. Let's talk about Rachel Reeves. The new Chancellor made a big speech in the House of Commons on Monday where she accused the previous government and Jeremy Hunt, the former Chancellor in particular, of leaving a £22 billion overspend in the public finances, which she claims the Conservatives basically covered up. As a result of that, Rachel Reeves says, the new government has to make some very, very difficult financial decisions, which include ending winter fuel payments for some pensioners, scrapping a pledge to build 40 new hospitals, although that was a somewhat dodgy Boris Johnson pledge to start with, and cancelling rail and road projects, including the infamous Stonehenge Tunnel, which it looked like was going to happen, and now it isn't. Here's a question, Pippa. What's the mood like among Labour MPs about this? I ask you that because there was still quite a lot of euphoria after the election result around, and this serves notice that government is going to be a grind.
I think if I had to sum the mood up of all those MPs in one word, it would be apprehensive. Because while many of them understand the political necessity of Rachel Reeves coming out really quite hard on the Tory record, you know, blaming them for a woeful economic inheritance, specifically saying that, you know, even though she knew during the election campaign that things were going to be pretty bad, it wasn't until she arrived at the Treasury 3 weeks ago that it had become clear that things that she didn't know and accused, pointed the finger of blame at the Tories, saying that they covered them up. You know, they covered up from the opposition, covered up from this House, were her words, covered up from the country. Labour MPs recognise that it's really important for them to help set the narrative in the really tough years that that are ahead. The example that they always share is George Osborne and David Cameron coming in 2010, after the financial crash, and blaming the difficult economic situation the country was in at that time on the Labour Party, and saying it repeatedly over, well, actually pretty much over the whole 14 years, but specifically, you know, at the beginning, so that it sort of entered the public consciousness, even after a few years later, George Osborne turned around and said, well, actually, of course it wasn't Gordon Brown. It was this international picture. It had become fixed as a sort of a clear point in political history. And Labour want to do the same now. So MPs get that. But of course, John, it's more complicated than that. And there are individual announcements in Rachel Reeves' speech, which people weren't expecting. So things like the winter fuel allowance, the fact that social care, the planned extra money, she says no money was there, but the planned extra money, the Dilnut reforms, which are due to come in next year, weren't happening. And then hovering over it all is this sort of fear that lots of Labour MPs have about the prospect of more austerity, because it wasn't just the fact that Rachel Reeves only announced savings cuts, call them what you want, of about 13 billion of that 22 billion, suggesting that more will obviously have to come in the autumn budget. It's the bigger picture. It's the sort of the so-called Sue Gray shit list or the civil service black swan list. You know, local councils are in dire financial straits. The criminal justice system is in dire financial straits. And these are long-term problems.
So the point is, not just that projects are getting cancelled and things are being cut, right? All Labour MPs, I would imagine, know that there are huge problems out there preying on their minds, which sooner or later, right, demand extra money. There's absolutely no question of that. And as much as anything, what Rachel Reeves was saying was, well, it's going to be very, very difficult for us to keep things bumping along the bottom as they are, let alone finding any money for anything else. And that then brings you to all of those questions, which by the time we get to the end of this year are going to be screaming out for answers. I mean, you know, there is the prospect of the annual financial round of negotiations with councils That starts to happen in November and December, right? Now, if you've got a chancellor repeatedly saying, look at the mess we're in, there isn't any money, and in fact, I'm having to make cuts. For all that you say that the Parliamentary Labour Party understands the politics of all this, that's going to make things somewhat bumpy, isn't it? There's going to be anxiety and tension flying around.
And she does have the capacity to make political decisions. And we saw that again this week when she made the decision to follow the recommendations of the public sector pay review bodies, which suggested an average 5.5% increase. Again, not all of it was budgeted for by the previous government. But that was a political choice. Now, she argues that was necessary to avoid the even bigger cost, potentially, of strike action down the line. Obviously, the narrative, again, of looking like they're in control and not sort of, it's been the whole time in negotiations with striking unions over the next year or so. But that was a choice, right? So almost half of that 22 billion was because of that.
Yeah.
And it will be the same going forward. There will be other areas where they make a choice. And as they did with winter fuel duty as well.
We don't know yet what she means by welfare. I've seen this in lots of briefings in The Guardian and elsewhere. They've talked about cuts and savings, and welfare has been mentioned. We don't know what that means yet. But for someone like me, that jangles my nerves, right?
Mm.
That does not sound like what I expected from a newly elected Labour government, I'll be honest.
No, but Rachel Reeves has always erred on the wing of the party. That think back to opposition and some of the controversial votes there where she, she backed welfare reform, as they would put it, but also ultimately is welfare cuts. And we know that the welfare bill is huge. We know that there's been a problem post-pandemic, and that some of the solutions that they've set out about, getting more people into work, about dealing with mental health and so on, are not things which happen very quickly. So I think we'll all be watching that with great interest.
Right, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll look at the Conservative Party, where things really are difficult, and bullying allegations made against the Tory leadership frontrunner, Kemi Badenoch, and who else is in the running for the party leadership.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian's series, Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Pippa Creera is still with me. Pippa, you've got an exclusive story in The Guardian about allegations against Tory leadership frontrunner Kemi Badenoch.
So this is a story that I've been working on for some time when I was approached by several officials, present and former, in her former Department of Business and Trade, which she ran for 17 months until the Tories lost the election, who started talking to me about the atmosphere that had the working culture that existed in the private office of that department. Now, the private office is basically a bunch of civil servants who work directly to ministers. And each private office is maybe only sort of about 10 people, but the whole private office directorate is sort of the same numbers for each minister and for the permanent secretary. So you're talking about 60, 70 people. And then as I sort of pursued these inquiries, I reached out to people. Some people got in touch with me. Other people passed on contacts and so on. I spoke, in depth to multiple individuals and built up this picture of environment that she led, which was basically fairly intimidating one. And some people even described it as toxic. And specifically, I was told that at least three officials found her behaviour so traumatising that they felt that they had no other choice to leave. And quite often these stories are quite difficult to write because, of course, conduct can be so subjective. And I found that when I was doing all the Dominic Raab story, stories back in, under the last government. So I was very careful to kind of interrogate and test what people were telling me and making sure that it was very well sourced. And there was also moments along the way that I sort of learned information which helped us build up this picture. So, for example, I was told that there was a sort of a regular town hall meeting for the directorate, which was put in the diary on 13th of December, attended by about 70 staff in person and online. But at that meeting, senior officials thought it was necessary to address the concerns about the working culture. They were so worried about it. I was also told that senior officials told the department's permanent secretary, Gareth Davies, privately about their concerns about Kimmy Badenoch's behaviour towards them. And there was no official inquiry because these complaints weren't official complaints, but that they were flagged to the Cabinet Office, Priority and Ethics team in at least one instance and were allegedly also passed on to a senior figure in number 10. Kimmy Badenoch's reaction has been quite interesting. I'm not sure whether you've seen it, John.
I've seen quite a lot of it, I think.
Should we say classic of the genre? In that she, first of all, defends herself, saying that she has very high standards, expects civil servants to operate to very high standards. You know, fair enough. These are generally robust individuals who are used to fast-paced and tough environments and often demanding ministers. But then she sort of kicks back with some really...
Well, she rejects the yes. allegations, yeah. doesn't she?
But crucially, she rejects the allegations and claims that they're the work of disgruntled former colleagues, and she has a range of criticism of them and their own behaviour. And it's just, you know, I thought it was really unusual that she came out. I mean, probably to be expected because she's known as being pretty robust but on the front foot with matters like these. She came out and tweeted about it and, you know, that denial. I guess because she wants to make it clear to Conservative MPs going into the leadership contest, as far as she's concerned, these allegations are incorrect, because they could potentially be damaging, not necessarily in all of the substance, but because Tory MPs, John, are very bruised after a really serious election defeat. And one thing pretty much all of them agree on is that whatever the Conservative Party looks like going forward, it needs to move on from like the division, the infighting, the chaos that absolutely hung over it for at least the last 2 or 3 years, if not more. And Kimmy Badenoch basically reminding everybody that she is quite punchy, metaphorically, and that she, as one person put it to me recently, can't walk into a room without starting a fight, is not necessarily the answer to their fears over how the Conservative Party is viewed.
Yeah, we will come on to some of that in a general sense, these questions about tone and what might work for the Conservative Party at this point or not. Just remind us in a matter of 2 or 3 sentences where Kemi Badenoch is coming from politically or ideologically in this leadership contest. She had a piece in The Times sort of setting out her stall, which was full of sort of vague bromides and platitudes, but then also reprised some of her culture war rhetoric. She talked about postmodern decadence and stuff. We know she was in favour of Brexit. She's quite free markety and small state. So she's a creature of the Conservative right, but not as out there on the right as Priti Patel, and certainly not as out there on the right as Suella Braverman, who, as it turns out, isn't standing. Is that
broadly accurate?
Yeah,
and I think she's trying to occupy the right of the... She wants to be the candidate of the right, because that's, as we've seen historically, where the party membership, which gets the ultimate vote, tends to pitch. But also she will know, and she ran for leadership last time around and came fourth, that she will know she will need to win over some of the more centre and moderate of the wing of the Conservative Party as well, if she's going to even get to that stage of the final two. She's pretty socially conservative. She's very anti-woke, and she's very much on the gender critical end of the trans right spectrum. She's definitely interesting from a journalist perspective. Her sort of ideological outlook is quite interesting. And that piece that you mentioned was also a bit of like a rebuke to a couple of her leadership candidate rivals, James Cleverly and Priti Patel, who had basically come out when they declared and said, look, we need to unify. And her argument is like, unity is not enough.
We should remind ourselves as well, the Conservative Party is a complicated and nuanced thing, in the sense that, notwithstanding the fact that it tends or has tended in recent years to speak in this very strident, socially conservative vocabulary, half the field are people of colour, and there are two women of colour here. Mm. There's never been a Labour leadership election, anything like that, right? So that of itself is remarkable. Anyway, let's talk about sort of tone and, I don't know, sort of behavioural disposition across all the six candidates. We all know how political parties tend to behave after a big election defeat, certainly if it's the first one after they've been in government, right? They tend, as we both know, to double down on what caused the defeat in the first place. The Labour Party tends to do this. The Conservative Party does it even more so. And in the case of the Tories, this is the part about tone, it seems to me that that problem may be made worse by how they have been speaking, you know, what the sort of outward broad message that you hear from them for a long, long time. They tend to sound obstinate and shrill and self-righteous, right? So even now, the most Brexit-y culture warrior Tories, like Kemi Badenoch, don't sound self-critical and open to new ideas at all. And this is their moment of defeat, where any rational outsider would say, you need to have a long, hard look at yourself here and figure out what has gone wrong, right? We're not hearing that really from Kemi Badenoch. Let's just go through the rest of them. Tom Tugendhat. He will sound a little bit more self-critical and questioning, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, that's very much where he's pitched himself. You know, he's a Tory centrist. He's probably the most left, or the most moderate, as they like to say, of the Conservative candidates. When he ran for the party leadership in 2022, his pitch then was he was untainted by by Boris Johnson's chaotic administration. Obviously, he has been serving under Rishi Sunak as security minister. But he's pretty much, I think, been working on it since 2022 for this moment, which I think he, like many others, thought was inevitable. And even he, as a Tory centrist, has done his sort of like his pitch to the right.
Oh, he has,
by
yeah.
suggesting he was open to pulling out of the European Convention on Human Rights, which I don't think anyone thinks he actually believes.
Exactly. But these are these themes, these very arcane, strange-sounding issues to most voters that if even Tom Tugendhat sounds like he's open to doubling down on them, we all know where we are, right? Next person, what about Mel Stride? Mel Stride's a bit of an enigma here. He's a sort of a somewhat faithless Tory journeyman, isn't he? But he fancies his chances in the sense that he's declared that he and successfully got through enough nominations to stand.
Yeah, and why not? I mean, he's a staunch he's a staunch Sunak loyalist. I don't know how many of our listeners know much about him, but he kind of became slightly better known in Westminster circles due to his frequent media appearances as the Conservative general election campaign headed for what looked eventually to be almost certain disaster. And he eventually became one of the few ministers that would put the head above the parapet and come and defend the Sunak government. So, you know, he is loyal, if nothing else.
Okay. James Cleverly, sort of more centrist and moderate than Kemi Badenoch and Priti Patel, not quite as centrist and moderate as Tom Tugendhat. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
His big claim to fame in my head is that he privately described the Rwanda scheme as batshit, which shows you he's not way out on the right.
I think it was not entirely unhelpful for him in terms of his electoral chances, if not with his chances within the Conservative Party itself, for that to have come out. But yeah, he's pitching himself as a centrist, but one with broad appeal. So he voted for Brexit.
He did.
But he also took a swipe at the right of his party, warning them against sacrificing pragmatic government in the national interest on the altar of ideological purity.
Oh yeah, well, we all know what that means. He doesn't really like shrill Brexit culture or politics.
No, but he's a good communicator, and as you say, he is somebody who's well liked at Westminster, including crucially within his own party, because he's seen as somebody that is a unifier.
Okay, Kemi Badenoch, we've talked about. But the one line from her Times op-ed I didn't mention, which I thought was brilliant, was, "We talked right, yet govern left." That was a characterisation of the last 14 years. I must say, I missed the govern left bit. I got a lot of the talking right, but the govern left bit eluded me. Anyway, Robert Jenrick would presumably be of a similar opinion.
He was initially a fairly sort of run-of-the-mill centrist Tory MP, so much so that he was nicknamed Robert Generic by some of his colleagues. And then when he quit, and he was a close ally of Rishi Sunak, a very sort of loyal minister who occupied various posts, ultimately it was put into the Home Office as Immigration Minister to keep an eye on Sola Braverman. Let's not forget that. But then when he quit as Immigration Minister, he says because he thought Sunak needed to take a tougher line on both legal and illegal or irregular migration, he suddenly sort of like pivoted to being this right-wing, pro-tough immigration rules darling of the Conservative right. And he would have mopped up quite a lot of support at that end of the party as somebody who occupies a similar terrain to Kemi Badenoch, but maybe without the sort of combative, potentially divisive style.
Yeah, that sense, maybe one who's worth a punt, really.
If you're a betting woman, which of course I'm not.
Yes. And he's obviously, you can tell the sort of personal ambition has led to a sort of rapid reinvention of various kinds. I watched his video and he's clearly been down the gym and you know, and thought about
what he wears, all of that stuff. Yeah.
He's on manoeuvres. Right. Yeah. Last one, Priti Patel. Now, Kemi Badenoch, it is said, is the favourite, but Priti Patel runs her a fairly close second, right? Darling of the grassroots, right-wing, Brexity, culture warrior, famously in favour of hanging and prepared to defend it on Question Time. I'm sure that clip has now amassed millions and millions of views on YouTube. It's sort of infamous. She might do it.
Well, I think the interesting things about Priti Patel in terms of this contest are that she has focused a lot on the grassroots membership. I mean, she knows where the votes lie. The last two candidates that go through the MPs process go to the Tory membership and they then decide which is the winner. Also, should Boris Johnson decide to endorse anybody, and currently we're not expecting that, but should he do so, Priti Patel is his great mate. They're very close. And I would absolutely expect, even if he doesn't come out and endorse anyone publicly, it to be let known that he would back her. And as you know, he is also, still remains, despite everything, incredibly popular with the Tory grassroots. So those things potentially could work in her favour.
And then Suella Braverman has decided not to throw her hat in, which some people are quite surprised by. What does that tell us about her and the Conservative Party, do you think?
I think even though she said that she got the 10 MPs backing her that she needed to reach the nomination threshold, I think she was realistic enough to know that her prescription for how the Conservative Party can build back post-election defeat was not going to get an airing or a much support amongst the Tory MPs. So she was never going to make it through to the members. And she, out of all of the high-profile Tories that we've talked about, is the one that repeatedly people ask the question about flirtation with Reform and Nigel Farage. And I don't think we're going to see her jump ship to Reform, but she's at that wing of the Conservative Party.
She really is.
And I think that relationship's going to be an interesting one to watch.
Okay, before we started this conversation, I had a look at the speech David Cameron made to Conservative Party conference, which, according to legend, is the one that sealed him as the next Tory leader and the one who would lead them from opposition into government in 2010. And at that point, the Conservative Party, after, three defeats, was prepared to hear that they needed to fundamentally change, right? He said, we have to change and modernise our culture and attitudes and identity. When I say change, I'm not talking about some slick rebranding exercise. What I'm talking about is fundamental change that shows we're comfortable with modern Britain and that we believe our best days lie ahead. He was very combative, wasn't he, and confident in his message that the Tory party had gone down all sorts of dead ends and now it really needed to shift. We're not going to hear that message this time around. And in that sense, I don't think this is going to point to Conservative revival, this Tory leadership election. This is another staging post, really.
I think you're absolutely right, John. And certainly there are plenty of self-aware Conservative MPs that feel the same, that so few of the candidates seem to recognise that elections are won from the centre. And instead, they're talking about not being Conservative enough at the last election, and that's why they lost. And so if their response to all of this, to response to that massive historical election defeat, is to pitch further to the right, then they're going to be out in the wilderness for many years to come.
We shall see. Thank you for joining us, Pippa, as ever.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening out there. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. We are now going away for a bit for what remains of August, but there will still be stuff from us going up for you to listen to. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Kakute, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jett.
This is The Guardian.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian series Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.